Either way, welcome. We're so glad you're with us. If you're joining us from one of our Atlanta area churches, whether on the north side, south side, another church across the country or around the world, we're thrilled to have you with us. Or you may still be on fall break and joining us from there or someplace in the world where you haven't found a local church. We do have a network of churches we'd love to try to get you connected into. A couple weeks ago, we started a series that we're actually concluding today, and it's called Worth the Wait. And we, in this series, have been talking about the fact that many of us have been in seasons or are in a season where we've waited on something. Some of us in prolonged seasons of waiting. And you've waited on something, and it's not something trivial, it's something significant. And you were waiting maybe on a specific physical need or a financial need or a relational need or it was a professional need. And maybe it was something that you had invested in for a while or you were working toward or dreaming of or you were hoping for. It's something that somebody convinced you that later is greater and that to play the long game and that, you know, short-term loss is long-term gain and you're waiting. You're waiting for that to come to fruition. Or maybe you would say, some of you would say you're waiting on God. Maybe you've prayed and prayed and you've been asking God and you've been looking for an answer to your prayers. You're looking for clarity or for direction or for healing maybe or for help. And last week or a few weeks ago, we introduced the three primary, and this is from a psychological perspective, the three primary reactions that are triggered in us in seasons of waiting. And they're this. The first one is discomfort. That none of us, the idea of waiting is uncomfortable for us. It's powerless. Sometimes we feel powerless. We feel helpless. We feel stuck in seasons of waiting where we feel like we're sort of at somebody else's mercy. And then there's uncertainty. And we've already talked a little bit about discomfort and powerless. We're going to talk a little bit more about uncertainty today. But we've not just been talking about how to cope with these things and how to deal with this in the midst of seasons of waiting. We've been talking about what's on the other side of them. Specifically, what's on the other side of them that might be worth the wait. It might just be worth all of the waiting and all of the discomfort and the powerlessness and the uncertainty in the midst of that. And in week one, we discovered that God's up to more than we thought. And God does some of his best work in our seasons of waiting. And he's more interested. He's more interested in you being conformed than he is in you being comfortable. And it's because you're worth it. And specifically, your future self is worth the wait. That God's working in you, he's conforming you, and he's working for your good. And it's maybe not what you think of when you think of good, but God's conforming you, and you're worth it. Your future self is worth the wait, and it's worth the work that God's doing, and he believes you're worth the wait. Last week, in week two, we talked about this idea of feeling powerless, or we feel stuck. And one of the things we discovered is even in the midst of that, we can learn something. In fact, we can learn something significant that we carry beyond this season of waiting. We can learn to experience God's unexplainable peace as we learn to depend upon him. We find that God's peace-filled dependence is worth the wait. Some of you, you've experienced this, you've felt this, and you realized that in the midst of your waiting, it wasn't about doing more, it was about depending more that led you to that peace, that peace that's really unexplainable. Today, we're going to talk about uncertainty. And I hope that I don't disappoint some people today. The board's going to be really simple today. But it's going to be simple because of clarity and because the content is not simple. The content is complicated, but the board's going to be a little bit simple. We're going to talk about uncertainty. And specifically, I think the most frustrating part of the waiting is the uncertainty. In prolonged seasons of waiting, when you're not sure when you're going to get out of it, specifically, you're not sure how you're going to get out of it. You're wondering, like, how is this ever going to work itself out? Or how am I ever going to get to the other side of this? Or how will we reconcile? Or how will I ever get out from underneath the weight of this? Whether it's an emotional weight or a financial weight or pressure from a certain boss or a leader or someone in your life. How will I ever get to the other side and get out of this season of waiting? And when? When will I? When will I get out of this situation? When will I experience the payoff for the investment, the payoff for the waiting? And when will I get over whatever hurt or pain I've dealt with? When will I get over this situation or when will I get over them? And some of you have experienced that and you're not sure how it's going to happen. You're not sure when it's going to happen. And then there's the question of, will I ever get to the other side of this waiting? Will I ever find someone who's the right person for me? Will I ever get to the place where my circumstances change and improve? Will the pain and the difficulty ever go away? And then in the midst of that, it complicates things actually if you're a Christian. Bad news. It complicates things because in the middle of wondering how and when and will this ever change, you begin to wonder, why doesn't God do something? I mean, I've prayed. I'm trying to do the right things. It seems like God's attentive to plenty of other people. He seems inattentive to my needs and my desires. He seems attentive to plenty of other people around me. And you begin to think, like, they're not dealing with what I'm dealing with. Why am I the one that's having to go through this? And they're not even good people, by the way. Like, you're at least good people. And it's like, why are they not going through these things? And why am I doing this? I mean, after all I've endured, after all I've done for God, why doesn't God do something? And our real question is, why doesn't he do something now? Like, I don't want to wait anymore. I'm tired of waiting. And the truth is this question and God's inactivity, it naturally leads to other questions. It leads to other things that we wonder, and these are sort of the things that are beneath the uncertainty that we feel. Specifically, when it's related to faith, we begin to wonder, is God real? Like, does God really exist? Like, what's my evidence for that? Is God real? Like, he's not showing up. And I begin to question, like, is God real? And if God's real, does God care? Does he care about what I'm going through? Does he know? Is he paying attention to what I'm waiting? And is God even able to do something about it? We call into question the reality of God, God's care or love for us, and his ability to be involved in our lives. And this is natural and normal. However, don't leave right now. I'm gonna potentially offend you. This is not rational thinking. It's not even logical thinking. I mean, I understand why in the midst of uncertainty we ask these questions, but this isn't rational and it's not logical because someone's lack of activity in accordance with our desires, that happens all the time. And it's not proof for or against somebody's existence, somebody's love, or somebody's power. I'll give you an example. All the time I get notifications on my phone from my boys, primarily the younger boys. I get notifications because we monitor everything that's going on their phone. They need permission for everything. So I'll get a request for more screen time. Anybody ever get this? Like, constantly on my phone, I need more screen time. Or I'll get requests for in-app purchases or because they want to download an app and they're always coming on my phone. Now imagine if in the middle of waiting for that, if one of my kids went, you know what? I don't think my dad is real. Like, I don't think he exists. He hasn't responded to me. He's not doing what I need him to. He doesn't even exist. Or my dad doesn't care about me. He just doesn't care about me. Like, he didn't give me what I wanted. He didn't give me that extra time. Like, he doesn't care about me. Or maybe my dad just can't help me. Maybe he's old. Maybe he's just an unk and he doesn't know anything about technology and he doesn't know how to work the thing. If he clicks on it and goes to this, he can make it work. Maybe my dad just can't help me. Now, you think about it and you think, that's just silly. But it's the same logic we use when it comes to God. And it could be that as a good dad, like, I care immensely. And I do have the ability. And I do see their requests. And there's a reason I haven't responded. But from their perspective, they're waiting and they're wondering. And so this is natural and normal. It's just not logical. And here's the other thing. I'm gonna double down on this for just a second. Do you know we know neurologically that this isn't rational thinking? I'm going to prove it to you in just a second. Some of you don't check out, by the way. Some of you don't like the science. It's okay. You need to know this because this is your brain I'm about to talk about, and I'm about to tell you how it works. Not because I'm smart, because I have a good therapist who's diagnosed me and helped me figure out how my brain works. So that's how I know this stuff. Here's the thing. There's two things that are happening in your brain in uncertainty. First, you have an overactive amygdala. The first time my therapist said to me, I was like, so I'm screwed up, right? I'm like hopeless. He's like, no, here's what's happening in your brain. When your brain senses uncertainty, it treats uncertainty like a threat. It's like it's potential danger. And so when you're in a season of uncertainty, what happens is your amygdala signals the release of two significant chemicals. The first one is adrenaline, which you're thankful for because when there is a real threat, you want the adrenaline. It makes you run fast. It's how you get away. It makes you stronger. It provides a response. But here's what happens when you're in a prolonged season. This is what happens to your adrenaline. And your adrenaline goes up and down. And again, this is primarily triggered by your amygdala. And it produces this release of this adrenaline. And you have these ups and downs. Not only that, and which adrenaline is just a stress hormone. It's a stress reaction. It also triggers the release of cortisol. And when you first experience adrenaline, your cortisol level raises. And specifically, it's to help you respond. It's to regulate your adrenaline, but it's also, it triggers that fight and flight response. You're trying to figure out, what do I need to do about this? Here's the problem with prolonged seasons of uncertainty. Here's why we're talking about this. Because your brain doesn't know the difference. When you're waiting and you perceive there's some level of threat involved in that, and you're waiting for God to come through, there are certain things that happen in your life that trigger your adrenaline, that trigger your cortisol in long periods. What happens is over and over, your amygdala continues to trigger this. And what happens is your cortisol levels go higher and higher. Now, your base level of cortisol is at such a high level after a prolonged season of waiting that little things that would have never bothered you before, little things that would never have produced a trauma response or a fear response or a reaction in you, those little things now put you in the red and you respond in ways you wouldn't otherwise respond. And it's because of these raised levels of your stress hormones and in your amygdala's continuing to send out distress signals even when you're not in real danger. So this is natural and normal. So that's the first thing. And then there's a byproduct of this. I'm gonna, again, just pay attention. It's a little bit complicated, but this is what your amygdala is doing. It also has a effect on your prefrontal cortex, which is right here in your brain. Your prefrontal cortex is involved in rational thought, decision-making, and regulating your emotions. You can see the problem. So what happens is when your adrenaline and cortisol levels go up, the overactivity of the amygdala, it actually overwhelms your prefrontal cortex. And the brain then struggles in terms of weighing options and making decisions and being rational. It leads to indecision, and it also can lead to impulsivity. And the truth is it's like your prefrontal cortex, when it's experiencing this, its ability or its functionality, it's reduced. And what happens is your prefrontal cortex is like, it's impaired. It's like it's drunk on the chemicals that the amygdala is sending it. And it's impaired. And in the midst of that, you're trying to make sense of the world. You're trying to make sense of God. You're trying to make sense of your season of waiting. And whether you know it or not, this is all happening in your body. So here's why I tell you all that. Some of you are like, do we talk about the Bible? You're about to get a lot of Bible. I'm about to read you a story where all of this is going on. These are human people, and all of this is going on in their midst. And today, I want to conclude with a narrative that is probably the most important part of this series and the most important thing you need to know in the season of waiting, because it's core to our faith. The group of people we're going to look at today, they're in the midst of a real crisis, and they're wondering the same things. They're waiting, and they're waiting specifically on Jesus. And they discover something we can be certain of, even in the midst of uncertainty, even in the midst of our waiting. Now, this narrative's pretty long, so I'm actually gonna sit right here and I'm gonna read it to you. I'm gonna make some comments and then we're gonna conclude, because all the things that we need to know are in the story. So here's what's going on. There's two women, Mary and Martha, who are close with Jesus, and their brother, Lazarus, is sick. You know the story already. Don't run ahead. Stay with me in the story. Let's walk in the story together. Their brother's sick. So, we're told by John, the sisters sent word to Jesus. That's what they said. Lord, the one you love is sick. Which, how, wouldn't that be great? You don't even need to use your name. It's the one, Lord, the one you love is sick. And he knows exactly who they're talking about. If nobody's ever said that to you, that's how your Heavenly Father sees you. You're the one he loves. Lord, the one you love is sick. They're sending this message to him because They not only believed that he could do something, they knew he would do something. They knew he could do something. And they believed he would do something. And when he heard this, Jesus said to his disciples, they've sent word, he's not near them at the moment. He's in another town. And when Jesus heard this, he said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Which, okay, that sounds good, but I don't necessarily love the feeling of God using my pain and my sickness and my difficulty for his glory, but I'm hanging in there. Okay, I can stomach that. There's purpose in this. God's at work. He's not being inattentive. He's active. He's not absent. Now, Jesus, John tells us, loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was two more days, which is exactly what you don't do, right? When you hear of somebody who's sick, specifically on their deathbed like Lazarus, you don't wait. You get in the car, you jump on the plane, you drop work, you say, I'm gonna be out for a few days, and you just take off. You drop what you're doing, and you go. We all know that, but Jesus stayed put. And he not only stayed put, he sent no word about his arrival or when he would be there. He just waited. And consequently, so did they. And while they waited, they didn't know why he delayed. They didn't know why he was waiting. They didn't know how long they would have to wait for him to show up. Then, 2 days later, Jesus told his disciples that Lazarus had fallen asleep. And they didn't really understand. This is how Jesus, and he set the tone for this. Most of the New Testament, you'll see when they talk about death, they talk about it in terms of falling asleep. And that's because Jesus was laying the groundwork for, hey, death in this life is not the end. It's like going to sleep. And the truth is there's going to be a resurrection in the end. You're going to see. He's going to talk about it in just a second. But he basically told them they were falling asleep, that Lazarus had fallen asleep, and they didn't understand. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And then he says something that I don't think Jesus wanted to get out. At least it's something I wouldn't have wanted to be documented. He said, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there. That's at least insensitive, but seemingly indifferent, at least towards Lazarus and Mary and Martha. Lazarus, the one he loved, and Mary and Martha, who John said he loved. He said, for your sake, I'm glad I wasn't there so that you may believe. And they're like, well, we already believe. We left everything, Jesus. We're following you. He's like, no, I don't think you understand. I don't think you believe like you're going to need to believe. And as a matter of fact, in the coming days, you're going to experience something that's going to test your belief. In the same way it's testing their belief right now. And so he says, let's go to him. And I imagine they're thinking, well, why now? I mean, you said he wouldn't die, you waited, he died, and now we're gonna go? It seems too late. And on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now this is important, because at that time, the ancient Jewish people, in ancient Jewish culture, they thought, and you can look this up, there's a commentary on the ancient Jewish people called the Midrash Rabbah. And in the Midrash Rabbah, it talks about how people believed that after 4 days, the soul would leave the body, that it would hover around the body for 3 days. And then by the fourth day, the body would start to be disfigured and the face would be disfigured and it wouldn't recognize the body more. And then the soul would depart the body. This is sort of what they believed. Again, this is on this side of the cross. And so this is what the Jewish people believed was the case. And that's important because Jesus is showing up on day four. And Bethany, John goes on to tell us, was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. This is a parenthetical thought. And many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. So ahead of Jesus, when he shows up, there's a whole bunch of people there because there were people, you know, not far away in Jerusalem that knew Lazarus and Mary and Martha, and they came to comfort him. And he tells us many came, but not the one they sent for. And not the one that they knew could do something for them in the midst of their circumstances. Not their savior. He didn't come. And when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. She didn't wait for him to get to the house. She went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Now, I'm reading between the lines. But I think there's part of me that's like, Mary's disappointed. And she's like, I'm not going. And I think Martha's mad. I think Mary's sad and Martha's mad. And the involuntary response or the involuntary sadness in her, which is what anger really is, caused her to go out to confront Jesus. Here's how I know. John goes on to tell us that Martha went out and Martha says to Jesus, if you had been here. And some of you can relate to this. You were in a season of waiting. There was something that was going on and you thought, God, if you had showed up. And seemingly God shows up and it's later. You're like, he hasn't shown up yet. And you're like, it's too late now. It's too late for me. It's too late for my situation. It's too late in my circumstances. And this is exactly where Martha's at. She goes out and she goes out to Jesus and she's like, if you had been here, where were you? Why were you waiting? Why were you late? If you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus, he responds to her almost immediately. He says, your brother will rise again. Which is like, no, wait, what? Martha goes, yeah, I know he'll rise again. At the resurrection of the last day, you've taught us about that. There's gonna be a resurrection in the last day. But the truth is he's died. He's dead now. And you were late and you could have rescued him. You could have saved him. I've seen you heal people before. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. And Martha's like, he believed in you and he died way too young. Why did you wait? Jesus is going, those who believe in me, even though they die, they'll live. And then he looks her in the eye and he says, do you believe this? Do you believe I really am who I say I am? Do you believe that I actually care about you? Do you believe that I am able to do what I claim to be able to do? And Martha responds, she says, yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. She's basically saying, look, I believe that you are the Lord. You're the Lord of all. You're God's final king. You've come into the world to rescue the world, to not just rescue the world, but to rescue us in the world, to rescue me in the world. Here's my question. You're Lord, but do you care? Do you care about me? Do you care about my sister? Do you care about my brother? And if you do, were you not able to do something? I mean, if you are Lord. And after she had said this, she went back and she called her sister Mary aside. And look at this. This is what she says. She said, the teacher is here. Which in New Testament terms, this was an indication of people who wavered or they doubted or they didn't believe in the authority or the deity of Jesus. They thought he was just a good rabbi. He's just a good teacher. And here's Martha wrestling. She first called him, I believe you're the Lord, you're the Messiah. And she goes back to Mary and she said, the teacher is here. She said, and he's asking for you. And when Jesus saw her, Mary, weeping, and the Jews had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and he was troubled. He asked, where have you laid him? And they said, come and see. Come and see, Lord, they replied. And they took him to the tomb. And then when Jesus arrived at the tomb, the verse that is so famously the shortest verse in the Bible, two words, Jesus wept. He wept. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems curious to me. He knew what he was about to do. Most of you know the story. I mean, he knew how the story was going to end. But if you have kids, you know that even when kids go through something difficult and you know it's gonna be okay, you hurt with them. If you have a good friend who's going through something difficult and they think it's the end of the world and you know they're gonna be okay, it's maybe the end of one thing, but it's the beginning of something new, your heart hurts with them when you really love them. And this is where Jesus is. In fact, the Jews that were there, they said, see how he loved him. But some of them said this, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? So here we see it again. This is confusing. It's like, okay, we get it. We get it that you loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And if you love them and you're Lord, maybe you weren't capable. Maybe you weren't able to do something. And it's at this point, everybody's asking the same question. If Jesus, he's late and he waited and he didn't come right away. And he obviously, they believe he's Lord and he loved Lazarus. Why didn't he do something? And this caused all of them, the disciples, Lazarus' family, and the crowd to question their belief in Jesus. And they're asking, you know, could he, we've seen him heal other people. Could he have not healed this man who was dying? And Jesus, once more, deeply moved, came to the tomb. And look at this, it was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Foreshadowing. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man. John wanted to make sure we knew. John was there. He's one of Jesus' disciples. He wanted to make sure we knew that Lazarus was dead. By this time, there's a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days. Which, if you like the old King James Version, the literal old King James Version says, Lord, by this time, he stinketh. He stinketh. You don't want to open that. And besides, his soul is gone. It's too late. And then Jesus said, did I not tell you if you believe, if you truly believe, you will see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me, that I am who I say I am, that I am your son, that I am the Messiah, that I am Lord of all. And when he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. They believed based on what they had seen, not just what they heard. Not just what somebody taught them or what they theorized, but based on what they had seen, they believed. And they all learned something really important that's incredibly relevant to all of us in seasons of waiting, even when we're disappointed and when we're discouraged, when we feel powerless, when you feel all of these things. In seasons of waiting, they learned an important lesson that we can borrow on today. And what they learned is that God's will and God's way is worth the wait. If you could ask them, you better believe Mary and Martha would say it was worth the wait. They wouldn't have had it any other way. They wouldn't have wished he would come right away because of what God was up to and what God was doing was so much bigger than this. Now, here's something you need to know. Lazarus died again, and Jesus didn't raise him again. He raised him the way he promised. And there will be a bodily resurrection at the last day. That's a promise. But his soul, when it became absent from his body, it was present with the Lord in heaven. He was with Jesus. No one could have predicted what happened that day. And they were all grateful. They would say it was worth the wait. And no one would have predicted he would do it again. You see, this was important because some of these followers would go on to be some of the followers that would be so significant in telling others what they had seen. A different time, a stone was rolled away. See, what happened is exactly what happened again. God's people had been waiting and they had been wondering. And the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans, he said, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Now, very rarely would anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. Not somebody who just plays the religious game, but a truly good person, maybe. But God demonstrates his love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He died for you. He died for me. Christ, the King, the Lord of all. He proved his divinity. And he did it by giving up his life out of love for you and for me. He's demonstrated God's love for us. And then he not only conquered sin, but he conquered death. And through his resurrection, he was seen. And many would go on to profess their belief and their faith in the resurrection of Jesus, not based on what they heard, not based on a teaching, not based on his prediction, because they saw a man die and they saw a man raised, and some of them for the second time. And they would give their lives for it. And in seasons of waiting, in the uncertainty, that's what we hold on to. I don't have answers for all of your waiting. I can't explain on the circumstances. I can't explain why God doesn't do something. This is the question we ask. Why doesn't God do something? And the answer is he can. And he has. And he will again. I don't know how. And I don't know when. But he'll do it again. Your question is, but why doesn't he do something about fill in the blank? And you have a situation. You have a circumstance. I'm not making light of any of that. We all have our own fill in the blanks. And here's the thing. For some, it keeps us from fully trusting God in some area of our lives. And for others of us, it keeps us from really trusting God at all. For most of us, this is what we're in the midst of. And the levels of our stress emotions, they're going crazy. And we've been at this a long time. You've been waiting. And the truth is it's impaired your judgment. It's impaired your thinking. It's making you ask normal questions, but they're not logical. I had a season like this. I'm not pointing a finger. Some of you, I've told a little bit of the story. I've told about a season when we were certain that God led us towards something. And we moved, and it was really, really hard. I didn't understand it. In fact, I wouldn't have gone had some of the miraculous things that we experienced happened. I was absolutely clear this is what we were supposed to do. I could take you to the booth in a certain restaurant where I sat with Annie. I said, tell me I don't have to do this. He said, if everything you're telling me is true, this feels like an obedience issue. And we knew it was. We knew this was something we were supposed to do. I got there. It was super hard. I remember not one day, not a few days, weeks of days driving from my office to home at the end of my day, telling God, if this is what it is to follow you, I don't think I want to. Not with my career at all. Why are we here? Why did you bring us to the desert? I don't understand this. I'm waiting for things to turn around, but it feels like everything I do, things continue to get worse. I'm not the right person for this. Why am I here? When are you going to show up? Why don't you do something? And I was doubting God's goodness, and I was having a conversation with my therapist one day. And she said, how's your family doing? I said, that's probably the one bright spot. I said, this has been a foxhole experience. My wife and I, our marriage has probably never been better, and our kids are thriving. God gave us a home that feels like an oasis, and we love being there, and we've established all these new family traditions, and you know, it's amazing. And she looked at me and she said, you need to hold on to that. You need to hold on to that. And you need to remember why you came here in the first place. This was a step of obedience. I mean, I could tell you story after story of the things that God did. There was this crazy thing that happened this one time. The first time we went out there, I didn't want to go visit. They were trying to get us to come to visit. They wanted me to come interview. I didn't want to do it. We ended up going out there, and I went and we sat down halfway down in the church. Nobody knew who we were or why we were there. We're sitting in church and, you know, like here, the music starts and we're singing songs and we sit down. And my wife is not a very emotional person. And we sit down, she's got tears streaming down her cheeks. And I thought somebody died. I was like, what's going on? Like, are you okay? What's wrong? And she pulls her journal out and she opens it up to a certain page and she hands it to me. And written in her journal, it says, Lord, you keep bringing me back to these same two songs over and over. And I don't know what you're trying to teach me. And it was the two songs we had just sung. And we knew. I remember telling my counselor that. She said, you need to hold on to that. Here's why. Why hold on to it? Here's why she's saying this. Is because when you have something that is certain, in the midst of uncertainty, that certainty is what breaks this cycle. See, this is raging inside you. And this is gonna continue to happen as long as you wait. And as long as there's uncertainty, your brain's gonna continue to send signals that says you're in danger. You have to look out for yourself. Nobody cares about you. There is no cosmic God that's a genie out there that's gonna come show up for you. It's not gonna happen. And the roller coaster ride of your emotions and these stress hormones, they're gonna continue to rage until you hold on to something certain. And since the beginning of our faith, this is what Christians have held on to. Over and over and over, believing that God's will and his way are worth the wait. It's woven into the fabric of our faith. It's the essence of our faith. Since the beginning, it's Abraham and Sarah waited for the promised child. Joseph, when he was sold into slavery, he waited till God raised him to the second in command over all of Egypt, as he told him he would raise him up to be a leader over all people, and his brothers would look up to him. And King David waited. He was told he was gonna be the king of the nation, and as a child, as a teenager, and he waited on God to bring that about in his life over and over and over. People have waited on God. It's been the nature of things. And when God comes through, and when God shows up, his will and his way and his timing is always worth the wait. Waiting is not wasting. God is working while you are waiting. He's conforming you. He's teaching you to depend on him. And he's guiding you toward his will and his way, his good and perfect will, and his good and perfect way for your life, for your good, and for his glory. Let me pray for you. God, I pray today for somebody, I imagine in this room or in one of the other rooms that's linked up with us today, and another church, maybe another part of the city or another state or another country, or somebody watching online. Somebody is wondering, is this God even real? And too many of us, we've seen him. We've seen too much. We know too much. We've seen him show up. And even in the midst of our waiting, each time he shows up in our lives and in the lives of other people, it gives us confidence. And today I just pray that there would be a sense in them that the only reason we gather and the only reason anybody gathers today all over the world is because Jesus was who he said he was. He did what he predicted he would do through his death and his resurrection. And people saw him, they were so bold, they made sure we knew what they had seen. And that you're not only real and you not only love us, but you are willing and able to work on our behalf for our good and your glory, and you're doing it. God, I pray you'd give us the patience in our seasons of waiting to know that your will and your way in your timing is worth the wait. I pray for somebody who's never placed their faith and trust in you, that maybe today would be the first day that they would decide they're gonna take themselves off the throne and they're gonna give you, make you the king of their life, make you the Lord of their life, surrender their will to your will because of the way you demonstrated your love for them when you hung on the cross and paid for their penalty and for their sin. And you conquered death, proving that if we believe in you, we experience a life, an everlasting life, a thriving life, a fullness of life that nobody can ever take away from us. I pray that there would be people that would cross over from death to that life, that kind of life today, and walk in that newness of life. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.